Robert Stark. I am joined here with Dean Clark. He's from the band Brutalist Architecture in the Sun. Dean, great talking to you.
Thanks, good to be here.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, nice talking to you.
Hi.
Dean, can you tell us about the history of your band, how you and your background in music?
Sure, no problem. So I started making music about 4 years ago from nothing. Then I just sort of decided that I had some music inside me that I needed to get out. And I started with a band called 3D, which is sort of still going on in the background. But at the same time, I had my own solo stuff called Brutalist Architecture in the Sun. And it's very much, you know, the electronic music from 79 to 81 is sort of in my blood. And it's just like my natural sound, really. So that's how I started with that. And
Are you talking about the early new wave, like Duran Duran?
Yeah, a bit of Duran Duran, sort of the normal Soft Cell, John Fox, very much love John Fox, and like Gary Numan. So all of that from 79 to 81, which for me is a bit of a golden period for electronic pop music. So all of the really big bands, that when they started off, the early stuff like Duran Duran, the first album, that sort of thing, the first sort of Japan, all of that was sort of the kind of sound that I was looking for. And we played live all around sort of clubs in sort of the UK and Kent. In fact, we've got a gig coming up 1st of April in Hoxton at the Siegfried von Underbelly. So we're looking forward to that. So we've been doing lots of rehearsals for that.
I was listening to your music. It's interesting as I kind of hear the influences from the early 80s synthwave music you were talking about, but also hear some influence from like 90s industrial music.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Front 242, Frontline Assembly, Skinny Puppy, Nine Inch Nails, all of that I very much love. And so it's a bit of a mishmash, really. A lot of people say the music's a bit like early 80s fused with 90s dance with a bit of industrial. So I guess it's all in there somewhere. Also, I do like sort of FM 84, that sort of Sega Blue Skies synthwave music.
I'm a big fan of FM 84.
Oh, love FM 84. And all of that sort of Time Cop, all those guys. And that's also in a track called Towers from the Concrete Pop album as a bit of synthwave in there.
Yeah, new retro wave. Yeah, on this show, we had Robert Parker from who does new retro wave. And then we also had N.S. Sean from Kim FDM.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, love all that. It's a bit of a broad church, really. I mean, I was brought up on electronic music, which I was very fortunate to do so. So it's a broad church from sort of Tangerine Dream and all that Berlin School from the 70s, all the way through to, Aphex Twin and Square Pusher. Anything electronic and got bleeps on it, I'm all over it.
What about, I really like One of Trick's Point Never. He's kind of up and coming. He's very of... very popular because he's actually cited as being the guy who kind of innovated vaporwave with his echo jams or eco jams, I think. And that was like here, he slowed down, I think Tears for Fears. And he kind of made that. He's on Warp Records. So he's like up there now with Square Pusher and Aphex Twin, One of Trick's Point Never.
What's his name again? I have to check him out.
One of Tricks Point Never. It's Daniel Lopkins. Okay. Or, I saw him in Philadelphia. He was very of. I think it's was his real. He's either known by One of Tricks Point Never or Daniel Lopatin. I think that's his name. But he's on Warp Records.
It's on Warp now. Yeah,
and he's kind of like it's that very post Square Pusher noise today in this the current year.
Oh, this sounds great. I'm definitely going to have to sort of check him out. And also in Brooklyn, love that cold wave stuff from like Marshall Cantorell and, you know, Zeno and Oaklander, all of that lot. Love that kind of sparse, minimalist electronic. You know, Adult from Detroit as well, I do like.
I like Adult too.
Actually, I saw Adult live in London, and the female lady, I can't remember her name, but she came into the crowd and danced with me. So that was that was a bucket list sort of tick.
Well, I remember I was listening to Adult when I was a teenager, but I never got to see them live. So yeah, you're pretty lucky to see them live.
Oh yeah, they're great.
Do you do the vocals, or does Cy Thomas do the vocals for the music?
So I started off with just me, and I rapidly realized that's probably not. I don't want a whole album of my voice ever again. So the first album was all me. The second album, I got some other vocalists in. And Cy Thomas, I've always liked. He's actually local to me, and he's been in rock bands. And we were sort of in each other's orbit as we were sort of doing gigs. I was doing electronic ones. He was doing rock ones. And we all seemed to be often on the same bill. And so I decided that I wanted him in the band. And so luckily he said yes. So this new album called Post Democracy, he's probably doing sort of 80-90% of the vocals, thank goodness.
Who does the most recent one? I see Concrete. I think it's Concrete Love Song.
Yes, that's me, Concrete Love Song. That's funny. That's one of those tracks that all came together and was all recorded and done in 2 hours. I just got the MS-20, Korg MS-20 analog synth. As soon as I got that first sound, it just poured out of me, and that was it.
That's funny because I had a Korg MS-20 Mini, and I had a SoundCloud project called Pizza Dog Studios. And what I would do was get the Mini, but put it through MIDI and get like MIDI files online and just make, I guess, Korg MS-20 Mini songs out of it. And just I would get old video game tunes and get the MIDI files and just mix it up. Into the MS-20 definitely has a interesting kind of industrial sound to it. It's a very... it's funny. I sold mine, but I like what Korg's doing with their synthesizers. They just made a new white version of the MS-20 Mini. It looks like a prop in a Stanley Kubrick film or something.
Yeah, no, I love the MS-20. Is a big part of my sound, and I've got the Korg Odyssey as well. So that's in the new album quite a bit. I only just got it at the end of Concrete Pop, so it's only slightly on that album. But MS-20 is all over it. And I use iPad as well. You know, I started off with just an iPad, and the Korg iPoly 6 I still use a lot.
I know with the aesthetics of the music, the designs for the album covers, it relates with the sound because you see a lot of this industrial imagery of old abandoned factories, but the color pattern relates more to kind of like what you'd see in stuff like Vaporwave and New Retrowave. You see that same theme of fusionism.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Brutalist architecture is all around us, and it's probably all around you as well. I mean, I was sort of brought up just outside of Basildon, you know, Depeche Mode's hometown, and that's just all, you know, it was one of the new towns that were created in the 60s, so it's all concrete. And so, you know, living amongst all of that architecture, you know, it gets inside you, and it has a certain sound of itself. It's very difficult to sort of escape it. And but also, I don't want it to be too depressing either, because that's not where I am either. So actually, that's why live I always have my, you know, fluorescent glasses. I have a bit of retro synthwave alongside the, you know, the minimalist and, you know, all the early sort of 79, 81 sort of synth sounds as well. So it's. It's not all po-faced.
I briefly lived in Plymouth, England, and that city, they completely rebuilt it after the war. So there's this kind of if you've ever been there, it's just like uniform style.
Yeah, that's right. And it's the same with places like Southampton, any places that got bombed a lot. And even in London, there's still some 60s tower blocks there. The there's some wonderful places there for brutalist architecture. Now, it does get ratted on a lot, but I've always, and I don't know, maybe it's because I was brought up amongst it, but I actually find it quite beautiful, and it can be very striking. And so no, I'm not anti-brutalist architecture, that's for sure.
It's interesting how there's a different genres of brutalism. There's one, like the kind of stuff that you would see when I was living in Plymouth, it's brutalism, but it's very kind of simple and bland. Then there's the more kind of industrial brutalism, like those skyscrapers like built by Arno Goldfinger, the Trellick towers. Have you seen those?
Yeah, I mean, well, because that was... See, the stuff that you would have seen in Plymouth, they're cheap. You know, we needed to build things. We didn't have any money after the war, so we had to build stuff on the cheap. So that's your cheap brutalist right there. And then you've got people who use that style to actually make a striking statement. So then, you know, the Trellis Towers is a great point. And, you know, the East Europe as well, they've got some, you know, in the old communist countries, they've got some amazing sort of striking brutalist architecture where they were sort of trying to make a statement with it.
And then there's the more kind of a glitzier form of brutalism. Like, if you're familiar, there's a center point in London, if you're familiar with that building.
Yeah, no, I'm I walk past it quite a lot. I mean, yeah, Centrepoint is a huge building, and although I don't know if you've ever been near it, but it has a sort of an underpass, and it's always sort of slightly smelling of wee all the time. So every time I see it, you know, I get the smell of wee. But that's the shame. A lot of underpasses around here, people tend to use as a public toilet.
And then I guess another example is there's this American architect, John C. Portman. I sent some pictures of his work. He's done all these hotels in all over the United States. But his style, it's basically like neo-brutalism, but it's very glitzy. Mm. Like there's a lot of gold and glass.
Yeah, I felt a bit of that. I don't know if it was one of his, but I've stayed at the Strand in New York. It's on sort of stilts that go over the old train track from the old meatpackers side of town. And that was also quite, you know, it's like an old sort of tower, felt like an old tower block. And they'd really sort of spruced it up. But it had that brutalist sort of element to it as well. And this, you know, a lot of bars, you know, I found around New York and Brooklyn, and you'll see that in Berlin as well a lot. And about the rest of continental Europe, they have a lot of exposed brick, exposed concrete, and sort of cold steel, sort of industrial sort of vibe about it. It seems to be in at the moment.
I know it's like really fashionable to kind of hate brutalist architecture. I know there was, I forget the name off the top of my head, but there was this French film that came out in the 60s that sort of was a critique of brutalist architecture. But I like the aesthetic of that film, and I also, I guess even like Clockwork Orange is definitely brutalism.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, brutalist architecture is now being listed in this country so that it's being protected. But back in the day, you know, it would have... People didn't like that kind of architecture because it was quite cold. We were smashing people's houses that were, you know, sure, they were getting old and maybe not fit for human habitation, but people were living within their communities. And then we smashed their houses and put them in tower blocks and separated them from their extended families. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why it does get ratted on quite a bit. But not so much now, I think. I think it seems to be going back in fashion. And whilst... you know, they get that lot of industrial and brutalist look is coming back in, I feel.
Well, I know the creator of James Bond, he actually got the idea for the name of the villain Goldfinger because he really hated the Trellick Tower.
Really? Oh, well, you know, it did get hated on a lot, but then a lot of people have, you know, you can buy models now of the Trellick Tower, and it's on T-shirts. It's become a thing. It's a symbol. And but not a bad one, I don't think. It's I think architecture is quite important, isn't it? It really does impact our environment and how we, you know, how we feel even. And I think British architecture now is, because it's been around for so long, it now has a sort of charm and appeal to it. Maybe it needs to get old a bit before people could sort of warm to it. I don't know.
Yeah, there's that kind of sense of urban grittiness. I mean, I remember visiting London. It's a different atmosphere as opposed to if you go into a lot of the newer high-rise districts that feel a little bit more sterile. But I know I have seen proposals for new skyscrapers that are kind of influenced by their brutalism or 60s and 70s kind of futurist architecture. So I could see that coming back in style.
Yeah, I mean, you know, London will always never feel sterile because it's, the streets are still the old medieval streets. There's no grid patterns that you would get in a modern city. I go to Perth quite a bit in Australia, and that's all grid. And obviously, New York is also a great example of that. Even Glasgow actually has a grid as well. It's quite modern. But in London, it's all, it's a windy, windy streets. No matter how modern the architecture, it'll always feel, bit warm and not like most modern cities, except when you go to Canary Wharf, where it's just all sort of offices. That is on a grid system over there, and that is sterile. I'd find it a sort of live and work around there, I have to say.
And also a lot of the underground stations are in brutalism.
Oh, absolutely. And, in my other project 3D, we actually recorded sort of train sounds and used that in a sort of an angry way on a track called I Want to Riot. This is how we felt, with the economic situation. We just wondered why people weren't rioting in the streets with such, difference between the haves and have-nots. And I guess it's similar thing to what the new Depeche Mode single is all about as well, Where's the Revolution? So we were sort of doing that 4 years ago. So that's using found sounds around us is quite important as well.
We actually were just talking about Where's Revolution on the last podcast with the Snog, actually, about its meeting and whether that song, depending what it means or in the context, this is a digression about Depeche Mode, but if you think about the early Depeche Mode releases, like Black Celebration and Music for the Masses,
Are you talking about the song Just Can't Get Enough?
No, I'm talking about the really dark period. Like, there was this fascist period or totalitarian period where they basically were talking about, nationalist politics, and it seems like on the new album they're, I guess, going back to that with Spirit, especially the Zine, where you have like the marching feet on the front cover and the whole Where's the Revolution? Because before that, they seemed to have different periods, and they seem to be going back to that. I don't know where brutalist architecture could follow in that, but.
Well, I do hear people compare brutalist architecture to things like fascism or communism a lot.
In Eastern Europe, that is absolutely the case. It was used in a very fascist way, and it was used to, awe-inspiring and to actually keep people in their place. Brutalist architecture in Eastern Europe has a slightly different connotation to the warm and fuzzy way we look at it in the UK and sort of maybe in other areas in Europe. But in terms of, where we are, politically, I mean, we try and be sort of dispassionate observers, just highlighting issues without necessarily going on either to the left or to the right. The track Industry was all about the deindustrialization, these skilled working men have nothing to make anymore, but it's also sort of a sense of hope as well, that you could just put that to one side and actually try and do something together. And you find cooperatives sprouting in those old towns where there used to be a mine or a factory. And so there is a way forward, but it's not going to be the same future as we imagined back in the 60s and 70s.
Or, Robert, if you ever listen to the Depeche Mode album, Construction Time Again, and the song Pipeline, that might have to do with architecture. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and that was all about, I think it was all about, where corporate interests go in front of the interests of the, of nature and society. And I think that's kind of where they were going with that album, I think. they wanted to smash it all and start again. I seem to remember one of the lyrics. We're in a similar place now. You know, I love watching videos of urban exploration, and you get a lot of that in Detroit. I imagine you've probably got tours doing that. And some of the sounds, like I think Abandoned Factory was actually, you know, inspired by those sort of urban sort of exploration, which I do a little bit.
There's a YouTube series I enjoy online by Bright Sun Films. It's called Abandoned. And what they do is they talk about a franchise that's abandoned, and then they go look at that urban exploration from Blockbuster Video, Roland Acres Mall, Nickelodeon Studios. And you basically click on one of them. They have this 20-minute documentary about it, and it's really cool when they do that urban searching through that.
I on Facebook, I'm in the group for Dead Malls Enthusiasts. You know, where malls are dying all over the, you know, in the UK and definitely in the US, where they sprouted like wildfire in the 80s, and now they're sort of dialing back. And so people go in and take photos of these malls where it used to be bright and happy and full of people in the 80s, and now they're just, you know, abandoned, and but still with the shop fronts. It's very eerie, but I do like it. I don't know what it's saying. I don't know what we're going to replace these things with. It's a sort of a death of one era, and we're not entirely sure what the next era is going to be like. We kind of feel like we're in sort of in transition.
There's a similar music genre that I got interested in. It's called folk horror, and there's actually a book based upon it. I think it's the Folk Horror Collective book. And they've also been saying that there's movies, music, and culture based around folk horror. And the main music based around it is Boards of Canada and Brian Eno. And supposedly they're influenced by, you know, like BBC, like commercials of the past, these kind of grainy footage, some nostalgic memories of an old 70s film. And if you kind of place that and look at some of these desolate architects, especially in the folk horror genre, like there's, I think there's a Brian Eno song, Lizard Point, right? It's about Lizard Point, and it's this kind of desolate area, and it's just kind of scary and kind of, but you're in that, right? The same could be said about Boards of Canada with Gio Gatti and Tomorrow's Harvest.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I love those artists. And, you know, I was brought up on the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. So we would have videos at school, and it'd be full of this bleak electronica, very like Clockwork Orange style before you get into the program. You have to have like a minute and a half of this strange music. And then throughout the program, you'd have this strange music. And I guess that's, you know, that impacted people like Aphex Twin, where, you know, it gets into your DNA and you can't help but to have it influence you. So that's in there as well. And, we were very fortunate, I think, in this country to have such bleak electronica forced upon us because I think it's done us good and it's created some great music out of that. I've got a sort of another side project called The Board of Medway, which, you know, I'm from Medway in Kent. And so I have little electronic vignettes all of sort of from my local, you know, local landmarks from sort of walking around. And I'm very much like that, like Brian Eno, Lizard Point, that whole album was music out made for a specific geographic location. And yeah, that's a big influence as well.
You were recently listed as a band of the month for Artifactor Radio. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was amazing. Yeah, so Renato, who owns the sort of station, he's a bit of a he likes brutalist architecture in the sun, so he I think it's very much his influence that he's pushed us forward, and it's been great. You know, it's been fantastic. And Artifactor Radio, I mean, they've got some great radio shows on there. I mean, it's what they've done in a very short space of time is nothing short of amazing. And and in fact, it's their 1 year anniversary show that we're playing at Siegfried von Underbelly in Hoxton on the 1st of April. And there's some great bands as well. It's just an honor just to be on the same stage as some of these guys. And they've been playing that Concrete Pop album quite a bit, which I'm, you know, immensely grateful for. But it's done quite well. I mean, I've actually, you know, we've had quite a lot of radio play across the world, you know, from actual dark wave clubs in Paris. Some DJs have got hold of it, to you know, radio shows in Australia, you know, Europe, UK, America, and also, weirdly, quite a lot from Peru and Brazil. So that seems to be, and Greece as well. Those three places seem to be the most popular for this music. I don't know why.
You're saying where most of your fans are from, they're mostly in either Europe or South America?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It we've got a lot of interest from Brazil, Mexico, and Peru. I think they do like their dark wave stuff, and I think they never went out of it. From, you know, in the 80s, it sort of just dissipated a little bit over here. Whereas they seem to be still strongly into it, which is great. All power to them. And and Greece as well. I guess maybe some of that is to do with the music, where we're talking about the economic situation, which probably chimes with them a bit as well.
Well, dark wave, I kind of associate it more with Germany. There's like Project Pitchfork and Dunkelwerk. Have you heard of those bands?
Yeah, I know Project Pitchfork very well. I've got a few of their stuff. And I guess it's most popular in Germany, isn't it? So I guess people automatically think of Germany, but it's everywhere. You know, East Europe, there's a lot of it there. In the UK, there's a lot of dark wave stuff. But then we all grew up on goth music, like The Cure and Bauhaus. And so it's all there in our DNA. South America, they have quite a lot of big concerts there. You know, Clan of Xymox go over there, and they have huge crowds.
Yeah, when I was talking to Robert Parker, he said the same thing about New Retro Wave. Most of the audience is in more Europe than America. I don't know why, but it seems to be. Have you been getting a lot of responses from America?
It hasn't been too bad. It's hard to get noticed anywhere, but in particular in America. But, a lot of the retro synthwave, all the great stuff, is coming from America. And a lot of the great cold wave music, minimalist music, is coming from America. And then, obviously, you know, you've sort of woken up to IDM as well. So a lot of the great dance music at the moment is coming from America. The talent that you've always had, but it seems to be coming out in electronic music quite a lot at the moment. And us Europeans, our eyes are on you and our ears.
It was kind of interesting, that comment you made about this sort of abandoned mall phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see what happens, because it depends in America. In a lot of lower-income areas, they just become completely abandoned. And in the more upscale suburbs, there, some of them are being turned into, like, outdoor malls. But it would be interesting to see them, like, turned into kind of self-contained cities and, like, utilized that way.
I mean, they've been sort of destroyed from a pincer movement, haven't they? So they've got the economic situation, so people haven't got so much money to spend. But also, on the internet, when we do buy, we're buying off Amazon and other places. So that people like Target and Walmart, they're all starting to sort of slowly die, aren't they? And so when you've lost your anchor tenants in these malls, they die. And yet some of them are great buildings. You know, it's a complete waste of materials and space. So I know in Detroit, they utilize these spaces a bit more now, and it's becoming quite hipster, I think, Detroit, from what I'm reading and what I'm seeing. So maybe Detroit would be the new Brooklyn. I don't know. But it would be good to, it's all about people, isn't it, ultimately? And, old abandoned mine, factories in the UK become community centres and places where people can start new businesses and work together and make connections. And maybe that's the future for some of these dead malls. I don't know.
When did the whole deindustrialization happen in the UK? Was that under Margaret Thatcher? Because that was a big issue in our election. I mean, both Trump and Bernie Sanders talked a lot about deindustrialization.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It was always at some stage going to happen with globalization, and it was accelerated with Margaret Thatcher. Absolutely, with you guys, probably the NAFTA probably put the foot on the pedal for you guys. Whereas before they would make things here, they would now buy, make them in somewhere else a lot cheaper, and it'll be also, you know, we've got huge ships that have become really cheap to make and run. You know, it's very easy to import stuff. It costs a lot less to get something from China, make it there, and then ship it here. Somehow that's cheaper than actually making the thing here. And it's the same with America and everywhere else as well. So what do you replace those jobs with? And they never really thought that through. The people who make money made even more money, but they didn't really think through what the impact would have on the society. And you've got people who, not everyone can have a college degree and have a high-powered job. You have to have jobs for everyone. And what we did here was we closed the mines, we closed the factories, and yeah, for sure, some of them weren't profitable, but we didn't replace them with anything. And so now you've got this underclass of people who are not being served by society or the economy, and that's, you know, that's criminal, really. And I'm sure it's the same everywhere. These are not new or exclusive to the UK. I'm sure as you're saying, Trump and Bernie Sanders were saying things very, very similar. And I can see why, you know, we look at Trump over here and sort of aghast, but actually some of the things he was saying, I can absolutely understand why people were buying into it, because no one's got the answers. You know, people wring their hands, happy to have jobs shipped to overseas, and never really thought through what you're going to replace it with. You know, and you need to replace those jobs. So I can absolutely understand why people bought into some of Trump's messages.
And yeah, you see the same thing with politics in England. Like you see in Europe, you see a rise of anti-establishment parties on both the left and the right.
Absolutely. Although most of them are also full of people who you would describe as being, you know, part of the elite anyway. I mean, Nigel Farage, who, you know, I'm sure you've heard, big fan, you know, he's a big friend of Trump, and, you know, he's quite populist and right-wing, and yet he's an ex-investment banker, and he's got lots of money, and people say they're draining the swamp, you know, over here as well as over you know, in the US, and yet they surround themselves by people who are no different to the people they're ratting on, so it's, I don't know, I smell something fishy. All these populist, you know, all these messages, and they're just, I think it's just a ruse. I think it's just a smoke screen. I think they're representing the same people as the people that they're saying are the enemy.
When I was listening to a Concrete Pop, I got some very vibes from it, especially from the kind of the synth pop category, which reminds me of stuff put it out like on maybe Minimal Wave Records, or even earlier, if you were to go back, there's a Liaison's Dangerous is, was it Los Nino del the Children in the Park? It was like this old record from 81, and that was kind of like a very pre-electronic body music track. I'm kind of getting those vibes, especially from those old synthwave kind of pre-90s, and I like that sound a lot. In particular, I actually like this form of synth pop. It was probably in the mid-90s. This one band, Joy Electric, and his name was Ronnie Martin, and he had his own little scene of Christian synth pop musicians on his used-to-be Plastic Music label, and those were like Solvent. And Solvent, he recently was, he made that film I Dream of Wires, which was about synthesizers. Yes. Yeah, Solvent had a big part. He was very close to Ronnie Martin of Joy Electric, and there were also other bands like, I think, Norway and Bee Machine and Travelogue and Echoing Green, and I think Freeze Pop was in there too. There was this very twee synth pop area during that 90s and zeros era. But I was kind of following that for a bit, but it kind of, some of that one's music, Concrete Pop, reminds me of stuff that Bee Machine would put out. He's a lesser known name. He's kind of obscure, but anyway, it just reminds me of those three things, like Minimal Wave Records, Liaisons, and some of the Plastic Music releases of the 90s and zeros.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I didn't know all that history. I mean, I've heard and Solvent and play that quite a lot. And, you know, I love Minimal Wave Records and Peripheral Records and all, anything from that, I just automatically enjoy. And they always have some really classy photos of bands all in sort of black and white or grey, and that music I just enjoy a lot. And that Dream of Wires as well, I love the Solvent soundtrack to that is brilliant. And I think that's all in there. That's definitely in the DNA. That's definitely in there. But it's a bit of a mishmash. I do have an album by B Machine, which I do like. Anything obscure, I tend to like. Because I love the there's a bit of everything in there. I just can't help it. It's just I don't sit down and say I'm going to make a synth pop record or I'm going to make something that's going to be a bit like Solvent. It's just in there, and I can't help it. But hopefully, it becomes its own voice as well. I'm hoping I don't come across as just a Chinese market knockoff of all those great artists. Not that I'm that great.
Well, I think but of,
hopefully I found.
I think I've told this before. I think B Machine, he tries way too much to sound like Dave Gahan and just makes Chinese knockoffs of the Pesh Mode songs.
Well, you know, a bit like And One as well in Germany. They're a bit of a Depeche Mode knockoff at times as well. Absolutely. I mean, it's in there. I hope I'm not stealing people's riffs or anything. It's just when you're using the same equipment, when you're using analog music, you know, analog synths, it's very, you know, it has a sound of itself, and it's always going to resonate with some other, you know, a lot of these other artists like Solvent and all the others.
Yeah, there's definitely an influence, but I think your stuff is unique because there is that fusionism of the influence of the early 80s synth and the industrial music, and I do see that trend going on with fusionism in music. I mean, there's not as many entirely unique genres, but I do think fusionism can produce some pretty amazing stuff, too.
I hadn't heard of fusionism. That's interesting. I think that's absolutely right. And I think, there are no rules here, and we don't have to put ourselves into, neat and tidy boxes and folders. And I think if you enjoy industrial music and you enjoy synth pop, why not fuse the two together? That it can work. I mean, Depeche Mode did it in the mid-80s, didn't they? And it seemed to work quite well for them. And Front 242 is probably my favorite band of sort of the industrial side of things, and that will always be part of me. So you'll always have a slight Front 242 vibe to certain tracks. I can't help it. It's just I've just listened too much of it in my life, and it's in there. But yeah, things like Popular Lies on the album is quite heavy, and I made that when I was quite angry. And so that probably comes across a bit. That's probably my most overtly political track on that album. Fun enough, when we play that live, we play it completely different. It's the same music, but we actually have a sort of a synth pop vocal to it. And that actually works a lot better.
With the marketing for music, is there sort of a pressure to be part of a specific genre so you can market that music to a specific niche?
That's always difficult. I mean, I don't really want to. It's very it's hard when you do like a sponsored advert, which I haven't done, but it asks you like three bands that you like, so that people who like those three bands would automatically see your advert. And I struggled to find three bands that are, I guess everyone puts down Depeche Mode because everyone does that. But it's got so much of everything. It's difficult to, I've always sort of, because of fusionism, the thing that's going to always probably make it not so popular is the fact that it's a bit of everything. So it can't be everything to synth pop guys. It can't be everything to like the industrial crowd. And they might like it, but it's going to be hard to sort of get that music in front of them. It's neither one thing nor the other. It's something else. And that's what I find. I mean, if I was on Minimal Wave Records, I'd be made. But, when you're doing it yourself, it's very difficult to market successfully, I find. And there's so much music out there. You know, why would they listen to Brutalist Architecture and the Sun as opposed to a lot of these other great bands? And I do feel for the old bands who are, signed to record labels, they're in the same boat as everyone else, and they're finding it hard to get you know, the Client, which I love, the great band, but they were recently, their new album didn't get anywhere, and they were sort of moaning that there's too much music out there and so they can't get heard. Good stuff always rises to the top, I like to think, but there's so much good stuff out there. It's, you know, I go to Bandcamp and, you know, I listen to so much stuff and it's all great. You know, a lot of it's so good. There's so much good music out there. I mean, people say music today is rubbish. It's absolutely wrong. There's some fantastic, beautiful, stirring music, as good as it ever was. And there's a lot of it. It's just finding it. It's difficult because we haven't got record shops anymore. There's nowhere central for people to go and talk about things. It's dissipated over the internet. So it's a great tool to finding great music, but it also dissipates the message a bit as well.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I think with the internet in general is it creates more of a genuine free market. It allows different ideas, new genres of music to get out there, as opposed to in the past where you had to go through a specific media outlet, whether it was like news media or a record company. But then there's also kind of – then it's also being able to find it and market it. As you said, it kind of dissipates things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Knights of Reb, a great band from the UK, they sold 50,000 copies of their Belief album in America. There's no way they would sell 50,000 of anything anywhere across the entire world in this new world. So it's great for finding music. It's for people who consume music, this is a golden age. But for people who make music, it's a golden age for getting in, actually being able to make music and get it out there. But you're not going to make any money out of it. Not that you really ought to be into it to make money, but all the same, you can make a living. It's very difficult to make a living out of music now.
Especially as with most of the music is available either on people just listen to it on Bandcamp and YouTube, and you can make advertising with YouTube, but if your music is available on these platforms, it make it more difficult to sell work.
Yeah, and you know, people consume music, they don't want to necessarily own it. So Spotify and, you know, streaming services, that's enough for a lot of people. And you know, in the past, I'd had to pay £10.99 or whatever, how many dollars, $12 or what have you, for a CD. And they probably only liked two or three tracks. And they only really wanted it for two or three tracks. But now they can either stream it when they want, or they can just buy the one or two tracks they wanted for 99 cents, you know. And so it works for them. But people like, you know, you and I, you know, where we'd like to have the whole album and absorb it and listen to it, that sort of world is going away, I think. Maybe vinyl will help. I mean, I know there's listening parties that happen in London where, you know, they put a whole album on and you know, a whole group of you, like a book club, would just listen to the whole album and then talk about it afterwards. Maybe it's you know, maybe that's the start of something, I don't know. But yeah, people just want to consume stuff now and throw it away. There's things that don't really have value anymore.
There's a website I've been following forever. It's boomcat.com. They're based out of, I think, Manchester in the United Kingdom. Mm. And what they do is they specialize in strange music on vinyl, cassettes, whatever medium. Now, the thing is, they're like no-name bands. They're just, it's almost like they're random generated art pieces. They sell music as art pieces. So if you go to boomcat.com right now, there's always something limited through, you know, 100 to 1,000 of a band you've never heard about, or a band made for that occasion, and it ranges from strange noise or electronic music to whatever, you know, danceable stuff. And it's just strange. So their business strategy is pretty much you buy pieces of art, or that you buy a thing you're going to sit down and listen to for an hour, 2 hours, like a movie, right? You go in the movie theater, you watch a movie, and these are kind of what they do at Boomcat, is that, you know, you can't even stream any of these guys online. They'll offer like 20-second samples of the music, which is so out there, and then it becomes pretty much a culture of, hey, I have this record by this X person. I think you should check it out, or at least, you know, that special thing that that other person doesn't have. And so Boomcat is basically there's certain, that's where I think the music industry is going right now. It seems to be that you have physical possession over an art piece rather than listening to music.
That's very interesting. I think you're right, and that sounds like a great idea. I never heard of that. I know people, I have seen things where people release cassettes in a limited run, but I never heard of Boomcat before. That sounds amazing. That's definitely but it can only be on a small scale. But that sounds like the way forward to me, because that's the only way that people are going to want physical possession of something is that it's, because there used to be a piece of art, the huge vinyl record. So I would listen to the music and also scour the artwork, and I'd understand, you know, who engineered it, who produced it, where it was recorded. And those, for some reason, that information mattered to me when yeah. as you're reading the cover.
I have good memories with the Talk Talk album, Spirit of Eden, just having that record on, finding it so weird, the music and the cover for that. But yeah, it's exactly any album you would look at that like that.
Do you design the album covers?
Yeah, that's all me. So the first album, All Is Grey, was, a typical sort of a council estate photo. And then this new one, Concrete Pop, a local artist took some photos of me. And we have a brutalist mall in our local town. And the roof of it was was a bus. Bus station, so buses would go onto the roof.
One of you in a train conductor's hat?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, it's a Belgian officer's hat, a military hat, and yeah, exactly. And it's that part, but they moved the bus station, so now you've got this abandoned bus station on the roof of a mall that's dying, and so it's a great place to have photos. So that's where. So it was in my local town, and that I thought that would sort of bring across whatever visual I was trying to achieve. Sort of, it's interesting, as I was having the photos done, people have to walk across there to get to the multi-story car park. So I got some strange looks from people with their shopping walking past in the background, and it's me with my hat and my glasses and my synthesizer having photos taken.
I know there's also the kind of like steampunk aesthetic thing going on, which is like based on the Victorian England. Are you also a fan of those old train stations, like Paddington Station, Victoria Station?
Oh yeah, I mean it's you look at it and you wonder, because we're not that great anymore. So when you see that, you're really looking A, at the past, and it's a beautiful piece of architecture, but also you're looking at, you know, what we once were. And so it's I love all that stuff. And cyberpunk, William Gibson, read all those books, and that fusion. I mean, the Victorians were quite ahead of the game when it comes to technology and architecture and some of the scientific thinking back in that day. And it comes across in the and they were never more grand than when they were building a train station.
There used to be this place at Piccadilly Circus called the Trocadero that was, it looked very cyberpunk, but I think they took it down.
Yeah, they did. It was amazing, that place. There was a Sega World there. There was this thing where you can go in that it was like aliens, and the people dressed like, the alien from the film, and you'd get chased around these scientific, around these space station corridors. And that was really frightening.
I have good memories of arcade machines too, especially with the Neo Geo machines by SNK. Or I don't know, I always have memories of that. The Sega World, when you mention that, there's a certain video. I don't know, video arcades are kind of dying too. It's a weird thing as well.
They're dead. I mean, they've got those. You'd have to go to a barcade where they have these old, there's that famous place, I don't know where it is, in America, where they've got all of the old arcade games, and it's where they have that Twin Galaxies, where they did all the world records. Have you seen that film, King of Kong?
King of Kong, no.
Oh, well, I recommend it to you. You'll love it. And if you like old arcade games, it's brilliant. Oh. But I miss going into an arcade and having those sounds just all around you. It's just the closest you get is, you know, if you go to Vegas and you have all those slot machines at a certain frequency that make you just feel happy. And it's those frequencies from those old arcade games that was, it's just, we'll never get those. You know, that era is gone, but wow, it was brilliant. I remember.
Yeah.
I was in the, you know, early 80s as well, I was in the arcade. So I remember when Pac-Man first turned up and everyone was amazed. Look, color graphics, and it was all a bit cartoony, and people were just, there was lines just to play it.
There was a documentary I saw, I think it was Man vs. Snake, and it was about this guy's obsession with this game called Nibbler, which was like this American snake variant game. And it just reminds me of that King of Kong. I can make a connection. There is this old school obsession with getting the most highest score, and then in Pac-Man you get to level 256 and the game freezes up and everybody, I think what, Ronald Reagan sent out a letter to someone who beat that, huh, got past level. That's the big myth, the present back then. I think it's true too.
Well, it's games now, and I still love video games. They're more of a story, and you're going to have an experience, and you're going through a story that the video game maker wants to tell. Whereas in those days, it was more gladiatorial. It was you versus the game, and you had to beat it. Of course, you never can, but it was more of a getting the best score rather than, you know, mm-hmm, having a fantastic story sort of unfurl around you. You know, I love, you know, things like Mass Effect and those games. You know, I love them, but they're very different to the Froggers and the Pac-Mans and the Dig Dugs I used to play.
Oh, yeah. I kind of, it's weird because I like those video games, but now all of a sudden I'm kind of analog, and I guess I play physical board games. You know, like, there's now Dungeons and Dragons, but now you're seeing, like, board games become a cultural thing again, and games like Cosmic Encounter.
You're absolutely right, you know, because, you know, in our local high street, there's now a board game cafe, and it's huge. And, you know, I love playing Boss Monster, and yes, it's, you know, it's become a big social thing now as video games became online, and that's great. So, you know, I can play with my friends who I wouldn't necessarily hang out with. But
is Games Workshop actually really big in your area, like play Space Hulk or Blood Bowl? I know those are there, some of those games. I mean, I don't know. It seems like no one really plays Warhammer 40K over here, but it seems to be a big English
It's huge
thing.
Here.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, we have Games Workshop, you know, there's one in our local town, and it's full of Warhammer.
Yes.
But it's all Warhammer. And it's a shame. I'd love to play Space Hulk. I used to play HeroQuest back in the day. But,
oh, yeah. I love HeroQuest, too.
Yeah. But you're absolutely right though. The physical board games is where it's at now. And, you know, I love physical board games, but I also love the social interaction. I mean, the amount of fun that we have playing Boss Monster, 4-player Boss Monster is, you know, you just can't replicate. You used to be able to when you had like 4 joysticks playing a video game, but it seems to be online rather than split screen.
I've talked about this before, but there's also a resurrection of the arcade scene, as there is something in New York City called Next Level Arcade, where they only play Street Fighter and King of Fighters, only fighter games only, and it becomes a skilled thing where it's bring your own joystick, play these games, and it becomes you versus another guy, like a competitive board game, but there's a digital, you know, board there. And so also there's another place called Baby Castles in New York, which is very artsy avant-garde video games where you basically treat games as art. And they're treating that as an arcade as well, this form of play. And so I guess the arcade could be certainly reinvented if it takes the strategy or the culture of the board game thing going on, but puts them to face-to-face interaction opposed to going on the internet using Skype and or Discord and playing internet, you know, EverQuest games.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's like as time moves on, we look back at those games and we see them as what they were, which was fantastic pixel art. And you know, when I you know, my children, I give them you know, I've got all the old machines. I've still got a ColecoVision, a Vectrex, an Intellivision, and the wooden Atari. I've got all of those things still, and I bring them out and we play them, and for them, they don't see it as an old game, they just see it as a different art style. So with that, they're happy to play a game with blocky graphics as well as playing Halo 5. You know, it's just a different art style. It's not necessarily going back in time to play a game. It's just a game, but with a different art style. And and also a lot of modern games, a lot of indie games use those blocky, you know, pixel art graphics as well, don't they? And I think, you know, as we look back, you know, we see it for what it was. At the time, they were disposable games, but now we look back and think, well, no, it was art. And it's great that people are repackaging things, a bit like, you know, the Boomcat that you were talking about earlier.
Or
they're doing that.
There's revival things like the NES Classic or Neo Geo X, where the system is reissued in our modern era. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can plug it into HDMI and it looks great. You don't have to have an old TV like I have to keep just so I can play some of the old same games. You know. It's great to be able to plug in an NES Classic and off you go. And I can't wait for, if I hope they do a ColecoVision one or a SNES one, I'll be all over that.
Played as a kid, like the Super Nintendo from the early 90s, like The Legend of Zelda and Mario.
Yeah, Legend of Zelda, that's amazing. Well, of course, the American SNES is but ugly though, isn't it? Compared to the Japanese and European one.
Yeah.
But the games are still the same. And, yeah, no, to be honest with you, I'd rather play the old Zelda than the new one, apparently it is.
Yeah,
but I don't know, I haven't followed, I played there's a whole bunch of Zeldas going back to the 80s. I played the one from the early 90s, Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past, then I played
one
that came out around 2000, and then the more recent ones, like I haven't played video games in a long time.
Oh yeah. I mean, for me, it's just the only RPG game I ever really played was Dragon Quest, and I've beat it every single one, and I've never really cared about RPGs since, and if there's Dragon Quest XI coming out on a PS4, maybe I'll play it, but other than that, you know,
Dragon Quest 9 was my favorite.
Oh yeah, 9 is fun.
I also used to like playing SimCity.
Oh yeah, SimCity, that's a good one. That's a very vaporwave one, too, if you think about that, Robert.
Oh,
that's
definitely. My favorite version of SimCity is on the SNES. That's my favorite version of SimCity.
Which one is that? Is that 3 or 4? I mean, there's a whole bunch of them.
It's the original one, but they put it out on the Super Nintendo.
The 80s, that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the original one from the 80s, it was just like a box, and then for a hospital, it would just be like a box with an H on it. Then now, I haven't played the most recent one, but the one now looks pretty amazing. I think the last one I played was like SimCity 4.
I'm just so grateful they brought back XCOM. That was my favorite game on the old PC. And now these new XCOMs, which are amazing. They're as good as the old ones. And the fact that you could play it on the iPad on the way home from work is just, you know. Mm. There's bits about this future, this new future that I love, and being proud to be able to play XCOM or a Dragon Quest game on an iPad on the train home. It's just, you know, for me, I've arrived. That's the future.
Yes. We are getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add about your band and your upcoming projects?
I've had a bit of a flurry. So since Concrete Pop was released back in August, I've written 25 songs, of which will be released 10 on a new album called Post-Democracy. And that's still poppy. It's still got the brutalist sound, but it's even more, if it's possible, it feels even more analog. And I've done a bit more physical playing as well. On Concrete Pop, a few tracks like When Is It Better and Concrete Love Song, I actually played live into the computer, but with analog equipment. But a lot of it was actually through the laptop. So now, this new album, I'm playing most of it live. So it's got more of that When Is It Better Concrete, but with a better vocalist.
I noticed Concrete Pop is more upbeat than your earlier work.
Yeah, it's very upbeat. And it's more upbeat than the first one, All Is Grey. And it wasn't particularly, it wasn't a conscious decision. It's just the way it sort of came out. And this will be plenty of beats on the new one as well.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Dean Clark for being on. It's been an excellent show. I'm a big fan of your music.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. It's been great talking to you about video games and tabletop games as much as about music. And I can't wait to hear the interview and listen to how bad I was.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
It's nice talking to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.